This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
the Law Society of Kenya says attempts by politicians to undermine the judiciary could destabilize the country during elections next month. Candidates from the ruling Jubilee coalition, including President Uhuru Kenyatta, have accused the courts of bias in favor of the opposition.
That's Mohammed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, a strike by government nurses in Kenya has entered its fifth week. And as South Sudan marks the sixth year of independence, some say there's little to celebrate.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: the Law Society of Kenya says attempts by politicians to undermine the judiciary could destabilize the country during elections next month. Candidates from the ruling Jubilee coalition, including President Uhuru Kenyatta, have accused the courts of bias in favor of the opposition. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
Some Kenyan politicians have questioned the independence of the judiciary ahead of the August elections. Law Society of Kenya President Isaac Okero says rhetoric against the courts must stop.
And they're being attacked on account of some decisions that have been made where they're sitting on a panel. This can only undermine the integrity of the election process and the rule of law. And it is only with strict adherence to the rule of law that we do not have a situation of anarchy. So it is extremely important that all citizens protect the independence and the integrity of the institution.
On Friday, the High Court ruled the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission must re-advertise the tender for the printing of the presidential ballot papers. The court said the process was marred with irregularities and a lack of public participation. The printing of the presidential papers was to start next week. In late June, the electoral body lost another case brought by the main opposition coalition regarding the announcement of the presidential election results. The court ruled the results announced at the polling station level are final. The commission wanted the results to be centralized and announced at the national level. The rulings angered the ruling Jubilee Party, which accuses the judiciary of working with the opposition and interfering with the work of the electoral body. President Uhuru Kenyatta raised the issue at a campaign rally Sunday.
Mimi nataka niwaambie wenye koti, tumewaheshimu.
The president said, "I want to tell those in the courts, we have respected you, but do not think respect is cowardice. And we will not accept our opponents to use the courts to intimidate IEBC, thinking that they will win using the backdoor to get to power. There is nothing like that." Kenyatta was speaking in the Rift Valley region, site of some of the worst post-electoral violence in 2007 and 2008. More than 1,000 people were killed nationwide amid disputes over the poll result. Chief Justice David Maraga issued a statement Sunday, calling the president's words at the rally concerning and capable of eroding public confidence in the courts. The ruling party spokesman did not respond to calls for comment. Senator Mutula Kilonzo Jr. is a lawyer and an opposition member. He says the campaign trail is not the proper venue to contest court rulings.
If they thought that they had an issue, that issue should have been raised on record so that then you can attack the ruling of the court based on the argument that you have presented. But by choosing not to participate in the dispute, they cannot now be heard to complain about the judgment.
With a vote less than a month away, political observers predict a close contest between the incumbent and the lead opposition candidate, Raila Odinga. The 2013 election had to be settled by the Supreme Court, which dismissed the opposition's contestation of a lack of evidence and declared Kenyatta as duly elected president. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Also in Kenya, a strike by government nurses has entered its fifth week. The Kenya National Union of Nurses, which has some 26,000 members, is demanding higher pay. Reuters quotes the union's chairman, Joseph Ngwasi, as saying, "The nurses are not out for the sake of it." He says union officials are ready to go to jail if necessary to give the nurses a collective bargaining agreement. While a deal was ready to be signed by the union and the government, the Salaries and Remuneration Commission rejected the agreement. The SRC also has announced it was cutting salaries and allowances for the president and other top officials and lawmakers. President Kenyatta has said that salaries are consuming half of all revenues and are slowing development projects. He's seeking re-election August 8th.
South Sudan recently marked 6 years of independence, but some say there's little to celebrate. Independence Day on July 9th was overshadowed by ongoing conflict and unprecedented food crises. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
For many observers, the situation in South Sudan is not surprising and to some extent is a continuation of politics formed by years of fighting for independence. Alex Diwal is the author of The Real Politics of the Horn of Africa, Money, War and the Business of Power. He says while political dialogue is paramount, the security and economic drivers of the conflict need to be understood and addressed.
The conflict in South Sudan is a legacy of the governance system that the SPLA inherited at the end of the Long War 12 years ago, which was a system of a sort of competitive, militarized patronage system, so that many armed groups were selling their services to the highest bidder. And when the SPLM-SPLA came into government, they actually adapted the same system in order for President Salva Kiir to control the territory, to see off his rivals, and to challenge the North. And that system is intrinsically unsustainable, and it allows for a very high degree of corruption.
The corruption includes billions of dollars in oil money that was diverted during the fight for independence, either to Sudan or to those fighting against Khartoum. Today, a similar pattern continues as rivals in the new country fight for access to oil proceeds. Agreeing with Dawal are representatives from the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, who criticize the worsening security situation in the world's youngest nation. Peter Beer Ajak is a member of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum and a senior advisor at the London-based International Growth Center for Fragile States.
I think the key economic driver to the war in South Sudan is actually the oil. The oil money, after it arrives every month, is used by the government to buy weapons, to continue to finance war, and to loot the money to be divided among a number of individuals. So these individuals that are controlling the oil have no incentives to end the war, because by saying that they are fighting the war and they are buying the logistics to fight the war, they can continue to loot the state and not allow peace to return to the country.
Ajak says 6 years after independence, one-third of the population in South Sudan has fled and 6 million people are in need of food aid. Author Alex Diwal, who is also the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School, says the so-called political marketplace is shaping the politics of South Sudan.
The financial and governance reform has to be an intrinsic part of the peace process. It is not possible to put back in place the old corrupt system, including the division of power, and pretend that that's a peace agreement. You have to actually have a system that is much more accountable to the people in the resources that it controls.
But many people, like Peter Beer Ajak, say reform is not happening quickly enough, and he criticizes those who say South Sudan's youth are too impatient.
I think what needs to happen now is a generational exit. And you heard how people were talking, that we are being impatient. How can we be impatient when 4 million people are displaced from their home? How can we be impatient when the inflation is over 800%? How can we be impatient when the country is facing famine and 100,000 people are facing potential starvation? How can we be impatient when 7 million people are facing humanitarian crisis? These mean we are not impatient. In fact, we are late. This should have been addressed yesterday, and it has to be addressed now.
Ria William Yuyuda a leader of a South Sudanese women's group, says change can be made from the bottom up with the involvement at the local level.
And what I wish for my country, like any other South Sudanese, is peace. Peace and unity. Peace and unity in a sense that all South Sudanese, we live together, love each other as brothers and sisters. Because if you love yourselves as brothers and sisters, you cannot kill your brother, you cannot kill your sister. Each one of us is doing different things to change the face of South Sudan.
For example, she says one of our friends is a coordinator of a youth group that advocates peace through art and music called Anatayan, or I'm Tired. Critics agree that regardless of solution, the work ahead is daunting. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The International Organization for Migration says so far this year, well over 100,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea. About 85% of them have gone to Italy. The IOM says Nigerians comprise the largest group, with 14,000 arrivals, followed by migrants and refugees from Bangladesh. Many others came from Guinea, Ivory Coast, Senegal, Mali, and Morocco. However, the numbers for those from Sudan and Eritrea have dropped by 50% compared to last year. The IOM's Missing Migrant Project reports more than 3,200 fatalities so far this year. Most, more than 2,300, have died while trying to cross the Mediterranean.
About 10 Malian soldiers are missing following an ambush by Islamist militants Sunday. Reuters quotes an army spokesman as saying the attack on an army convoy occurred between the towns of Gao and Manico. Four vehicles were destroyed in the attack. There has been a resurgence of militant groups in northern Mali after French forces pushed them back in 2013. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A strike by government nurses in Kenya has entered its fifth week. South Sudan marks the sixth year of independence. Some say there's little to celebrate. And the International Organization for Migration says so far this year, well over 101,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is on his third trip to Singapore since January for unscheduled medical treatment. The travel has prompted concern about the health of Africa's oldest leader and some criticism. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Rumors have abounded in Zimbabwe since late Friday when President Robert Mugabe left for Singapore, where he has previously sought treatment for eye problems. State media reported Sunday that the president is in Singapore now for, quote, a routine medical checkup, unquote. Regis Chikore, the principal director in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information, told VOA that reports on social media suggesting the president's condition is more serious are, quote, rubbish, unquote. A number of events, including the weekly cabinet meeting held every Tuesday, have been postponed for an unspecified, quote, number of days, said officials in the state media. The opposition says it is time for Mugabe, who has presided over Zimbabwe since independence in 1980, to step down. Jacob Mafume is the spokesman for the People's Democratic Party, PDP, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti.
He is now a visitor to Zimbabwe. His home now is Singapore, and in particular a certain hospital in Singapore. He is an inpatient who should by all means be in a hospital And the tragedy is that he should be coming out of the hospital into an old people's home, not state house. There is nothing magical about the office of the president that makes you not retire within the normal time. All other public service posts, people retire at 65.
In Zimbabwe, there is no upper age limit for the president. Mugabe celebrated his 93rd birthday this year and announced plans to seek another term in the 2018 elections. When he returned from a trip to Singapore in late February, Mugabe had this to say to those who wished he were dead or retired.
Vamwana tukakira the president is going to die.
Some say the president is going to die. Some wrote in the media that the president is sick, he has gone to Malaysia or Singapore, so he is on his way dying. He then continued in Shona saying, some people start making movements in anticipation of my death. I'm not going to die. Shame. Before he was in Singapore, Mugabe traveled to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for the semi-annual African Union Heads of State Summit and then to Swaziland. Mugabe also visited Dubai, China, Mexico, South Africa, Ghana, Mauritius, and Mali this year. The opposition says the high cost of foreign travel has become an issue for Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government. Official documents released by the Treasury show the president spent $50 million on foreign travel last year against a budget of $23 million. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
For millions of people in Africa and around the world, New York City means business. And when it's combined with great food, the combination can be unbeatable. At an international food show in the city earlier this month, 11 African entrepreneurs exhibited their wares. As VOA's Adam Phillips reports, they hope to entice American importers with their tasty products.
With over 2,600 companies from 48 countries, it's easy to get lost at the Summer Fancy Food Show this year. But Cosma Munze seems right at home. He's with the U.S. Agency for International Development's Southern Africa Trade and Investment Hub. USAID fosters trade between the United States and Southern Africa. Mamunze explains what the 11 African food companies the agency helped bring here have in common.
One, they are driven in terms of trying to expand their business. So they are hungry for bigger export markets. These are not large companies that we are working with. So these are companies that still need some hand-holding. So that's something that's in common.
Brenda Wilkinson and her husband own and operate the Rio Lago Olive Estate in South Africa's Western Cape Province. Wilkinson says that South African olive oil holds its own against the more famous Greek and Italian varieties.
South African oil, it's an amazing industry. It's very unknown, even in South Africa. And because it's so unknown, it's been very difficult for us to get out into the markets. That's why we're here, but also it would be lovely for everyone to understand that each producer is trying to make the best olive oil for the consumer. A little bit of ego, and the winner of all of that is the consumer. It's an industry to watch.
Nearby, Trevor Watson represents Luano Honey, a modest Zambian business.
Our operation is twofold. It is working with rural beekeeping communities in different parts of Zambia, and we organize the supply from them. We buy it as comb honey, we bring it into Lusaka, we process, we package, and we distribute.
What is special about this honey?
This honey is totally dependent on nectar from the flowers of indigenous trees. We process it without altering or changing the characteristics of the honey. So what you get in the jar is pure natural honey.
Luano Honey works with NGOs that provide rural communities with one beehive per family. According to Watson, many more hives are needed to make the business economically viable over the long term. For now, Luano Honey mostly sells to Zambian and Southern African distributors.
But we wanted to come to this show in New York to see what people want and what their perceptions are of African products. So it's really been an experience just to come and see what happens on the other side of the Atlantic.
Black Mamba Chili is a small company based in rural Swaziland. But Mark Pocock is eager to make its fiery organic chili sauces and chutneys a global brand. At the same time, Black Mamba is a so-called fair trade company dedicated to paying its workers a fair wage. Pocock says that can be a tricky balance in today's competitive market. But with the help of USAID and the NGOs, it works.
How it works is we commission an NGO to grow all our produce for us, depending on what we need, and we give them a premium price for that. The NGO actually trains ladies from the rural areas to grow to certain specifications and sizes, depending if it's chilies or mangoes. And they come and they set it up and they grow it. And when it's time for harvesting, they come through and we pay them directly a very premium price. And the NGO passes that on to these ladies.
Pocock says that Black Mamba's workers often become entrepreneurs themselves.
So some of them go back and grow their own produce. Now they have the experience, they know what to use, how to do it, when to grow it. So that's the most important thing. It's not just supplying us. Our goal is to employ as many people in Swaziland as possible. Unemployment is huge. There's a lot of people that are really suffering. The more we can do to contribute, better for us.
It's nearly closing time on the final day of the Summer Fancy Food Show, and exhibitors throughout the hall are packing up and offering free samples to buyers and each other. The African booths seem especially popular. Exhibitors hope this will mean many new American customers for their products and the employment and prosperity that could mean. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
A commonly used malaria drug appears to protect fetuses from the Zika virus, at least in mice. In St. Louis, Washington University School of Medicine researchers found that the drug hydroxychloroquine effectively blocks all viral transmission to the fetus. The virus has been blamed for a number of birth defects. The drug is already used in pregnant women to treat malaria. Researchers say more study is needed to confirm it has a protective effect on pregnant women infected with Zika.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the 29th African Union Summit that was dominated by discussions on war and conflict, but also talks on investing in the African youth. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com,
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.